Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Happy Tuesday. It is a happy one, actually, for Mariners fans, because that was such a fun game the other day. Jake, I don't want to put you on blast, but I know that you were freaking out when you were listening to it. And there were some lows, there were some angry moments.
Sound like
so
me
I
at
hear,
all.
I know it doesn't sound like Jake to be freaking out listening to something, but then there were some highs, and it ended with a high. Thankfully, Mariners beat the A's 6-5 in extras, thanks to a sac fly by Tom Murphy to drive Ty France home. And then you got maybe the best walk off reaction I've ever seen. I think definitely the best, one of the best walk off reactions I've seen. Top five.
It is legendary. It can't beat, you know, Griffey round in third.
No, I was thinking of that as I said it.
And the dog pile, literal dog pile at home base, you know, and all that, or home plate. But this is definitely one of the more memorable ones. I mean, it was a heck of a game yesterday, Stacey. It's a combination of fun and stress, and it makes for incredible drama. Like, that's exactly what you want in your baseball games, in sporting events in general. And yeah, I was driving back home listening to the game, you know, fist pumping. I was a complete wreck. I was yelling in frustration and in excitement. And then finally, you have the finish that you had, and it was incredible. As I was driving in gridlock traffic on the freeway, because it was Memorial Day and everybody's coming back home, so it was a great way to spend my time as I was driving home. Went back and watched the game because it was such an exciting finish. But I mean, seeing Tom Murphy's face, like, that's it was fun, but also it's something that haunts your nightmares.
In
like
the-
that is like, I don't even know what to describe that face. Just crazy eyes, Murph. Like, that was intense.
There is a backstory to that where it was in the Seattle Times. I guess Kyle Seager had gone up to Tom Murphy and said, hey, you need to have more fun out there, because Tom Murphy's just very intense and very serious. And so Tom Murphy initially did that face. It wasn't the first time he'd done it, but it was like as a joke to be like, look how much fun I'm having. And then he obviously did it again for this. Let's backtrack, though. Let's take a couple steps back, because there are so many moments I need to revisit. Let's start with this Donovan Walton home run.
Here's the stretch and the 2-2 pitch. Walton swinging a drive into right field and deep. Brown going back, looking up. Goodbye, baseball. How about that? Donovan Walton with a three-run home run here in the bottom of the fourth inning. And the Mariners have a 3-1 lead in the ball game over the Oakland A's. Donovan Walton going deep. And for Donovan, his first home run in the big leagues. How about that?
Someone's first home run in the big leagues might be one of my favorite baseball moments. You know how we all have weird moments in different sports where you're like, I don't know why, but this is my favorite. Like, I don't know why a you know, punt return for a touchdown, that's my favorite thing ever. Or whatever it is. Someone's first home run, especially if it's someone that's like, you know, not given that spot. It's not like Mike Trout. It's not someone where everyone's thinking, or Jared Kelnick, which that was really cool, but everyone's also like,
right,
Kelnick's going to be a star. Like, this is a guy that had to really work for it. And when you finally get that moment, I can't imagine how great it feels.
No doubt. And for Donovan Walton, I mean, who knows if he gets another opportunity like this again. And so it's very exciting for him to see him capitalize on the moment. His batting average hasn't been stellar. I mean, you talk about a 200 average. So far, he's been up, but he's been a utility player. He has had some moments. He's had some nice games, and this was certainly a major contribution to this win, a three-run shot. I mean, big time.
And there are a couple other moments we need to talk about, too. Let's start with this one, which involves two guys that are going to be part of this kind of core of the team, and one of them showing off some really cool speed. It's Kyle Lewis's single to drive in Kelnick from first.
The stretch by Caprillion, and there goes Jared. Pitch on the way, swinging a drive deep to left field off the bat of Lewis. This one is on the track and off the wall. Kelnick around third, being waved in by Manny. The throw in is cut off. Relay to the plate. Kelnick slides. He's safe. Mariners lead 4-1. Kyle Lewis in at second with a two-out RBI double. He drives in his 11th run of the year. First pitch swinging. Line shot to the base of the wall in left field. Kelnick was on the move. He scores all the way from first, and the Mariners now lead Oakland 4-1.
From first base, Jake. From first base.
That is a snapshot of the future right there, right? When you talk about the excitement and what things could be, that's what it can look like, right? Jared Kelnick being on base, Kyle Lewis driving him in, and hopefully hearing that for years and years to come down the line. But yeah, I mean, Jared Kelnick has absolute wheels. We've heard his speed, and we've seen him being able to steal a base here and there. But to be able to take a single and go from first base all the way to score, and that is straight up flying. So that was really cool to watch Jared Kelnick, and great to see Kyle Lewis get that RBI double.
Speaking of guys that are going to be part of this future, you also had the best outing yet of Logan Gilbert's young career.
Logan ready, looks in, has a sign from Godoy. Here's the stretch, and the 1-2 pitch on the way to Lowry. Swing and a miss, strike three. Got him with an off-speed pitch, and that will retire the side. A's get the one run, but that's it. What a job by young Logan Gilbert this afternoon.
Gilbert went through six innings, had five hits and just two runs allowed, walked one, struck out five. That is a nice outing for him, Jake.
A huge outing. I mean, when you talk about that type of outing, it was great to see the kid, Logan Gilbert, record his first quality start of his young career. I mean, that was big. I mean, Stacey, one of the things that you had talked about was you've wanted to see him be able to get deeper into innings. And that is a sign of being able to work through the count, being able to work through your lineup, being able to have control of your stuff. And what you saw from Logan Gilbert, I think, was a big step in the right direction. He was better with the location. He powered by some folks with his fastball, which he hadn't in the previous starts, really showed that he could get some major whiff rate with his breaking balls and mm-hmm. using it for strikes and using it to his advantage. But it was also a great reminder for everybody out there who was concerned with Gilbert that time and learning is important. That this is a process for these young guys. And for Gilbert, not having the traditional lead up and build up to being called up to the big league level. I mean, he was called up after one start, Stacey, in the minors, and he had only pitched four innings in the minors. So he is working himself up as he is at the big league level. So not only is he learning, but he's physically having to get himself ready to go unlike any other time. So I think for him, this is a unique deal, and it's important that we keep that in perspective. And it was really important to see Logan Gilbert have that kind of performance to just remind everybody that, yeah, this kid is good. This kid has special stuff. And when you look at what he was able to do, I think that he is learning on the job and had his first genuine breakthrough, and I'm really happy for him. Stacey.
And I think that there's a lot of very understandable anxiety, and I don't even want to say impatience. It's not impatience. It's two decades of frustration, right? It's so when you have guys like Kelnick, guys like Gilbert, and you tell fans these guys are the future, even though, I mean, we had Jason Churchill on with us last week, and we were like, hey, what are you taking from Kelnick's, you know, time so far? Because it hasn't been, like, off the charts amazing. And he said, Kelnick could do exactly what he's doing right now, and at the end of the season, I would still say it's too early to say anything, because he has that much potential and has been that good. And I think that that's kind of a similar approach people have been taking for Gilbert. I mean, not exactly, but it's that idea that you're being told this guy is going to be great. And when you see him, even though in any other year you would think it's so early to expect greatness, or it's so early to expect a player to get it all together, there's just this kind of, like, I don't even know how to describe it, like a waiting period that Mariners fans so desperately need to be over.
Well, I think there's anxiety, right? You're anxious. You're
and you know not everyone's going to work out.
Right. You know everybody's right. Not going to work out, and you want these two guys in particular to work out, because Kelnick is obviously the guy that's been touted as the superstar, one of the main cornerstones of this franchise of the future. He's a major key factor in hopefully working out for this franchise. It would be a massive jump starter to getting yourself back on the right track. And Logan Gilbert, obviously talented, but this was an evaluation of Jerry DePoto. He's the first of three pitchers that he drafted in the first round. You want to feel confident that Jerry DePoto, that you can trust Jerry DePoto's scouting evaluation in terms of these pitchers and what they can ultimately be. So that's why I think that these two guys in particular, not just because of the hype around them, But for those two very specific reasons and the importance that it carries, I think that those two guys have a lot on their shoulders, and that's why fans are so anxious as they watch them go through their lumps and experience adversity and want so desperately for them to succeed.
Then you've got Ty France. You're in extras. You're tied up with the A's. He comes up to bat. He's here. He's got two working wrists, and he's ready to hit.
Bearded right-hander comes to the plate. The pitch, swung on, hit. Left side, past the diving shortstop. Getting a wave on his Mayfield. Here he comes. Kemp's arm not very good. It's cut off by the third baseman. And we got a tie ball game at 5-5. Ty France comes through for the Mariners here in the bottom of the 10th at T-Mobile Park.
When that happened, I was screaming in my car, Ty France, you beautiful soul. I
feel bad for other drivers. Like, is this guy okay? He's just shaking the steering wheel.
Yeah, they might have been really worried about me. I'm not sure. But look, Ty France to me, obviously, when you talk about their winning streak that they're on, happens to be when Ty France came back into the lineup. Is it that much of a coincidence? I think it is, because when you add an extra major league bat, a legitimate bat like Ty France, when he is healthy, it really helps balance everything out for you. And Ty France, to me, has been the catalyst of this run. Now, the reason why he not only has hit, he's been clutch and he's driven in runs. You know, you add those three factors, he gives you a chance. And one of the things that I look at Ty France, it's really comforting to me where I can put blame on one specific thing. That drought, that hitting slump that he went through, we can confidently blame it on that injury to his wrist. Whether it was true or not, I think it did have a factor, but you can say that that's what it was, and seeing Ty France come back the way he has really been beautiful, and he has, you know, picked up right where he left off at the beginning of the season, and that's been huge for this ball club.
All right, and you've got France on third. Tom Murphy comes up to the plate, and you get this.
Here's a 2-1 pitch coming to Murphy. Trevino deals. Swing on, base hit. Make that a line drive, deep right field, plenty deep. Here comes France. He's steaming on the throw, not in time. Mariners win it, 6-5. Tom Murphy being mobbed. He's trying to get away. He's the strongest guy going. They're surrounding him, and he looks like he's a bull in a china closet. They're pushing him and shoving him as they celebrate on the first baseline. The Murph comes through with a liner to right to win the ball game, 6-5 in 10. Woo!
I loved this reaction. I loved the broadcast reaction, and I love Tom Murphy and the team's reaction. It was so fun.
It was a ton of fun, and I have to be honest here. I have to be, you know, full transparency. I was not happy when Scott Servais decided to have Tom Murphy pinch hit for Jose Godoy, because it's nothing against Murphy. It's actually a compliment to what Godoy has done. I thought Jose Godoy has done a very good job since he's been called up. He was great behind the plate yesterday for Logan Gilbert and the rest of the pitching staff. I thought he's done an excellent job behind the plate. Has exceeded my expectations there, and he's done a good job hitting. And he was 1-for-3 on the night and then they pinched in Tom Murphy. But you look at the numbers over the last 7 games for Scott Servais. This is an example of looking at what's going on recently and seeing a guy who is hot at the moment. I mean, you look at Tom Murphy's line here over the last 7 games. He's hitting, you know, .333, on base percentage .381, and a slugging percentage of .611. Two doubles, 1 home run. So I think that you look at Servais evaluating that and going, okay, Tom Murphy is hot at the moment, and I think he can give us what we need. And he struck out his first at bat, and he came through in a major, major way. Obviously, with that soundbite, Stacey, for an organization like this, moments like that are key. And I love seeing the way that they interact with each other. I love the fun that they had. And I love that they tried to dogpile or get around and huddle Murphy.
And
Murphy
he's refusing to allow them to take
right. He's basically fighting them. He's like a guy at a concert. There's a mosh pit going on, and he's that one guy that's just like taking it way too far. Everybody's like, bro, you got to chill. But Tom Murphy was looking for some action.
Did you see Logan Gilbert had this quote, and he's talking about Tom Murphy making this face. This is from the Times, and he says, I guess it's his thing. I try to stay out of the way. He's an awesome guy, period. He scares me sometimes. It killed me. All right. The only bad news is that Kyle Lewis did have to leave the game with discomfort in the same knee he injured in spring training. Obviously, that's not great. We'll get a chance to ask Scott Servais about that at 1 p.m. today. That's coming your way with the Scott Servais Show. Right now, though, it's 11:15. That means it's time for Three Questions, brought to you by Tila Mortgage.
It's time for Three Questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask. What?
All right, question one. This is still a story with the Julio Jones trade possibly going to Seattle. Today is the deadline where his cap, it would be a little less. Mm-hmm. So let's say he actually gets traded to the Seahawks. Which player would be impacted the most negatively by a Julio Jones trade?
Negatively? I don't know if anybody gets affected negatively other than the fact that obviously you can't get everybody the football.
Right, so from a stats perspective.
From a stats perspective, the person that probably suffers the most is the tight end group again. The tight end group, if you're looking for big production out of Gerald Everett, looking for big production from Colby Parkinson or Will Dissly, whatever it may be from that tight end group, I think that that's the group that suffers the most if that was to happen. I still think Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf still get their touches. I still think that those guys are featured in this offense at a high level, and they're performing at a high level in terms of touchdowns, in terms of yards. Maybe the receptions would be down a little bit, but I think that they would counteract that with how explosive this offense would be, bigger chunk plays for all around. So it would be the tight end group for me.
Yeah, I feel like in Family Feud when they're all, good answer. I keep seeing people say, look, it would, and I don't think this trade is happening, but I keep seeing people say, you know, oh, it would take away from DK, it would take away from Tyler, you don't want to do this. And it's like, no, you want the best player on the field at all times. What it's going to take away from is any extra targets that would have gone to other guys, whether it's passes to running backs or, in this case specifically, passes to your tight end. So, yeah, it takes away a little bit from the development of Colby Parkinson, but if you're choosing between throwing the ball to Julio Jones or Colby Parkinson, it's not a tough choice. No offense, Colby, right? We don't know what his career is going to be, but that group is who's going to be hurt there. Jake completely nailed that one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Number two.
All right, so yesterday, as you guys just recapped, the Mariners played an extra innings game for the first time in what seems like forever. And I honestly forgot about the base runner rule on second base. Like, Salk tweeted about this yesterday. I was running the broadcast, and I was wondering, how did the A's get someone on second? Oh, yeah, that's right. Is this the worst rule in all of sports? And if not, what is?
This feels like a leading question, DJ.
Well, he's going to lead me right into my opinion, which is yes. Oh. I think this is the worst rule in sports. Stacey, think about this.
It
drove me nuts to think that the Mariners could lose possibly on a single in extra innings. Because that's what the A's scored on. They scored on a single in extra innings. Are you kidding me? That's an awful way to lose after you've gone through the day like that. And already by that point, I am sucked into the game. I am all in. I've watched the entire game. I don't want it to be just, I don't want them to just wrap it up. I want them to earn the win. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's always great when you win and you come on top, right? You're never going to complain about it. But if they would have lost, yeah, it would have bothered me to no end.
Yeah, I guess it depends whether it's your team that's trying to, defend a lead. In this case, it's tied. But I don't mind it. I really don't. I have no issue with it whatsoever. I'm also not a baseball purist and an old school baseball person, so I will kind of offer a disclaimer there. I'm completely open to all the new rules that they're willing to try. I will add this, though. I don't think any of these rules does much to solve their bigger issue with pace of play. I think pace of play, and we've talked to Tim Kirkjian about this and other people how many times, that the bigger issue is where MLB is steering the sport as a whole by not caring about strikeouts, rewarding guys that basically boom or bust, hit home runs or strike out. And then also, nothing that you're doing is solving that bigger issue. I don't know how to solve the bigger issue. It requires more radical rule change that they aren't willing to instill. So right now, the runner on second, yeah, it can be annoying, but I don't mind it at all. It just doesn't solve their problem.
I'll just say this. I guess my problem with it is that they're saying that it's going to increase pace of play, like it's going to end the game sooner. How does it end the game sooner if every team has a great opportunity to score a run every half inning?
Also, you're
the
already
game goes
there.
Longer. Like the game's going to go longer.
There. I know.
Number three.
All right, question three. What weirds you guys out more? Tom Murphy's crazy face after he hit a walk-off sack fly yesterday, or Stacey's love for baked beans on a hot dog?
Okay, first of all, neither of you have admitted to trying this, so you don't get a hate on it.
Yeah, we do, because it doesn't sound good at all. I mean, I think what people have weird food tastes, okay? And that's your prerogative, okay? Stacey, it is your prerogative to like baked beans on a hot dog, even though it makes me want to throw up thinking about it, okay? But Tom Murphy's crazy face, it creeps me out. Like honestly, if you want to, go and stare at that picture or watch the video of him doing it on the Mariners' Twitter page, Instagram page, wherever it is. It's creepy. It freaks you out, especially in slow motion. Yeah, it freaked me out. It's not normal. It's not natural.
My love for baked beans on a hot dog doesn't hurt anyone. It's innocent. It's doing its own thing. Just let me eat my weird food. You know what I mean? Tom Murphy could, I think, maybe punch a hole through a cement wall. So, like, when anyone has that kind of face and he's, like, a very intense athlete, you're like, whoa, I'm not messing with that dude. I'm staying far away. I am Team Logan Gilbert on this one. I'm just like, he scares me a little bit sometimes. I'm not messing with that guy. I don't think it's... Also, my food takes are not that weird. I just would like to preface it with that. I think it's very normal. Oh, look at that. 206. I love baked beans on a hot dog. Thank you, 206.
Are you sure if I don't enter that number into my phone right now, it's not
me.
Your number?
You just see me texting below the table. Just, oh, look, someone supported me. How weird is that?
This is bizarre. No way.
Someone says
I'm going to try that later today. Well, good for you. I hope you.
Well, wait a minute.
Hope you come back and report tomorrow and let us know what you think.
Now, if I'm sending people to try this, I do want to give additional instructions. If you put baked beans on the hot dog with just a regular bun, the bun's going to get soggy. So the best way to do it is actually to toast the bun. Okay. Put the dog in the bun, baked beans, and then a little bit of bacon. Phenomenal.
Jeez. If you're going to do this, you might as well have a chili dog. Like, actually do it right
go
one step further and have a chili dog and put some cheese on it and do yourself a favor. Don't do this baked beans on a hot dog stuff.
206, baked beans on a hot dog slaps. Someone else says they've been doing that since they were in grade school. It's the best. Jake, it sounds like you're actually behind the times here.
No, I'm definitely not. Definitely not.
You're a little bit on an island with
you
the
are,
Mac
what
and
you are
text
speaking
right
to
now.
Is like such a weird section of our listeners that I just don't
I
quite
don't
understand.
Know. A lot of the listeners are supporting me. A lot of them right now. I'm feeling the love for the food takes, and I don't think it's that weird anymore. What a pleasant twist of events. I like that DJ included this question now. I feel validated. Thank you, DJ. Thank you, texters. All
this
right,
is
let's
the worst
get
thing that could have happened.
Let's
worst
get
thing.
Back to the conversation we were having about Julio Jones. I have a feeling Mike Salk is going to hate this one, but I want to know why. I want to know why he hates that a top tier receiver could potentially be coming to the Seattle Seahawks. That's coming your way next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Joining us now is Mike Salk, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, how was camping? You made it back alive.
I'm alive. Yes. I'm here.
Proud of you.
I took 3 showers and my hair still smells like campfire.
I'm honestly shocked that you stayed at the campsite presumably the entire time. I didn't think you'd make it to day 2.
Oh, no, we definitely left for a while. Oh. We drove around. We went out to dinner night 2. Yeah. Right. I mean, we went back to the tent to sleep.
Oh, you went out for dinner.
Right.
On night
we went
2.
To
nice.
A restaurant.
Yeah,
I
night
mean,
2.
Don't get
we
me
got
wrong.
Pizza. Yeah.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I mean,
night 1, though, we made walking tacos and we cooked a fancy breakfast of potatoes and eggs and all that. Like, we did it right.
Well,
we just just also went out for pizza one night.
You missed some big news when you were gone. Diana Russini on Sunday had a story that the Seahawks were kicking the tires on a potential Julio trade. You're already laughing and shaking your head.
So
I already know that you're thinking, who leaked this story? Is this from the Falcons trying to get more bids?
Well, maybe. I hope so. I hope that's what it is. Honestly, and we talked about this on the Brock and Salk podcast, which will come out tonight. This is one of those stories where when I came back, it didn't even dawn on me I would have to talk about this. I was like, oh, this is like when the 12s think they're going to get Jake Locker. It's so funny. Yeah. What a goofy idea. Obviously, that's never going to happen. But this is a real story. People think the Seahawks should legitimately trade for a 32-year-old wide receiver who makes a lot of money when they don't have any draft picks. They don't actually think that, right? There's no way. There's no way Seahawks fans think this is a good idea.
I mean, it's not just Seahawks fans. Everyone in
the NFL.
No, it's
Russell Wilson.
Well, no, but it's also because the Seahawks are a team that's like just crazy or bold enough to do it.
It's so stupid.
They've made some dumb trades.
Not this dumb. There's no way that the Seahawks will trade. I want to state this definitively to will it to be true. There's no way the Seahawks will trade for a 32-year-old wide receiver who makes like $35 million a year and needs to give up draft capital for it. What does he make? $25 million a year?
No.
15.3.
Yeah, 15.3.
There's no way. There's no way.
Let me ask you this. Let me pose this question to you. If the 49ers and the Rams go and acquire Julio Jones and they go to a Super Bowl and Julio's a great player, is it laughable at that point?
They're not going to go to a Super Bowl because of Julio Jones. They're going to go to a Super Bowl because they have great defenses.
Well, I'm saying they're not going to a Super Bowl because of Julio Jones. If he has a good year and they're explosive on offense and they're tough to stop.
It's not necessarily laughable for them, but they're in a different position. Their defenses are really good. And if that's the piece that they need to get over the top, fine. If you could trade right now the same amount for Stephon Gilmore, I'll do that. I'll sign up for that. I'm not like against the Seahawks making a deal for a veteran. They're both 32. They both make money. The idea for doing it for a wide receiver, it's insane. Tell me the last time the best wide receivers won Super Bowl. Never happens. I'm not saying you don't need wide receivers, but you've already got two, and you just drafted a third. You don't need Julio Jones, and you certainly don't need to trade draft capital and a gazillion dollars to make it happen. It's mind-boggling that this is even a story.
It would definitely be a surplus charge, that's for sure. This is definitely not about what you need. This would be about taking that piece. As you said, Salk, it would be obviously not to your liking, but it would be the piece that you'd say, hey, we want to make our offense that much more explosive. And I said this yesterday, is the frustration that I would have is ultimately if they made this deal, I would be excited about it. I don't think they're going to, but if they did, I'd be excited about it. Sure, of course. But it would frustrate me to no end that you'd be willing to pay that kind of money for a receiver and trade for a guy like that and not go out and just get Corey Linsley. Why wouldn't you go get a top flight center in the free agent market? To me, that would have made a lot more sense.
Or DN or any number of things that can affect your team more than having a 32-year-old Julio Jones. I don't mean to laugh at the idea, but it just seems so ridiculous. And the idea that this is something Russ wants, like Russell Wilson, if this is if it truly is what he wants, Russ should quit moonlighting as a personnel guy. Right, whether it's Greg Olson or Antonio Brown or not, like Russ, that's not his job. He's shown that he's not very good at it. Right, don't do this because Julio Jones would not be the thing that would help. And I'm not against them trying to get somebody else again, like corner or DN. Like there's a bunch of places they could offensive line. It's not just defense. Mm-hmm. But the idea of doing that for a 32-year-old wide receiver is beyond me.
It's got some shades of the Jimmy Graham trade to me, which I think this offense is in a different place now. Like, I wonder what the Jimmy Graham trade would have looked like with the offense they have now, with Russell Wilson where he is. But I say that, and the Seahawks have also not been able to make those big blockbuster trades pay off. It's like they have they're bold enough to make the move and just stubborn enough to not make it pay off.
I think that's sort of true. And maybe we'll see what happens with Jamal Adams. Maybe this will be the one that kind of truly pays off over time. It's funny you bring up the Jimmy Graham move because I believe it's the worst decision the Seahawks have ever made was in the John and Pete era. And it's not that Jimmy was that bad a player. It's that it specifically went against their stated identity. If you want to be a physical football team, you can't bring in Jimmy Graham to be your tight end. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. it goes against their vision statement.
It's like he'd be great for a finesse passing game.
That's right. And he is great in a he came from a finesse passing game in New Orleans.
If he would have gone to Kansas, say Kansas City's offense is what it was back in 2015, they would have taken off.
Perfect.
Yeah.
But the idea that he was going to come into a Marshawn Lynch, run the ball, like, it doesn't make any, oh, we're going to have him block. Okay. Let me see how that goes. And, of course, it didn't go very well.
Now, Salk, would hate to not bring this up while we have you, but that was a heck of a game yesterday for the Mariners.
Yes.
I was driving home, listening to it on the radio, fist pumping, yelling, screaming. I was going bonkers in my car in Memorial Day traffic. How was the game for you?
It was great. I turned it on in the eighth inning, just as Misevich came in and blew the game.
There you go.
Literally, the first thing I saw of the game was
Misevich. Did you turn it off when you did that?
No, but
thought, is it me?
I walked in, and he immediately walked the leadoff guy in the eighth, and I was like, all right, well, there should be some sort of punishment. Stone him or something. Like, don't walk the leadoff guy in the eighth with a two-run lead. Yeah, it's one of those good wins for them, and we talked a little bit about that on the podcast, too. Like, first of all, I hate the runner on second base so much in the game.
I like
it. Oh, my God, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it in ways that it's hard for me to process how much I hate it.
They stop it in the postseason.
They should never, ever, ever, ever do it. And I hate it to the point where I didn't even realize it's what had happened. I couldn't fathom how that base hit scored a run. I was like, where did that guy come from? Did he hit a double when I wasn't paying attention? Like, who is that? And it wasn't legit. And I'm not even making this up.
Fair.
It wasn't until the next half inning when they were like, Jack Mayfield starts at second base. Like, oh, right. We're still doing this stupid thing in the 10th inning. Oh, right. I've been watching this baseball game for 3.5 hours. Now I'm bored. Now I need it to be different than it's been for the, like, come on.
They're like, now we need to speed it up. So but, get that well, guy on second.
It's a great win for them. Good to see Logan Gilbert finally kind of be the pitcher that you're expecting him to be. That was a really good sign. And these wins matter, man. It's not that, like, it's not the win versus loss record that matters so much, but I think over time, given these guys the confidence and seeing what they can do, there's some value there.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, guys.
All right, we're going to get back to that Julio Jones conversation coming your way next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners continue their series against the Oakland A's today. Marco Gonzalez is back. He's making his official return in the rotation tonight. First pitch is at 7:10 p.m. Pre-game show starts at 6 p.m. right here on 710 ESPN Seattle. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. If you don't want Julio Jones, and there are some texters that don't, I'm seeing it right now, then what blockbuster trade in 2021 could the Seahawks make that would make you happy? And I'll tell you why I like this conversation. I'll start by saying it would have to be a deal they'd never make. In fact, I think, Jake, both you and I are in agreeance that, like, this Julio deal isn't getting done. Like, this is something that is very difficult for Seattle to pull off, and I personally think this is something that was leaked potentially on the Falcons' side of things to drive up more of a price for Julio. It's the same thing that was going on with that first-round pick. Oh, we got a first-round pick offer. I mean, I remember Christian texting in about that and saying, like, oh, they did? Oh, well, I'm surprised they didn't take it then. So I think that's what this is. It feels less like Seattle is really making moves and more like maybe they made a call because they're always in conversations for every trade. But there are other trades I'd be a little more comfortable with. If it was something for a star, this is would never happen. If it was something for a star corner like Jalen Ramsey or Jair Alexander, I would feel better about that. I got to admit, like, I would feel better about that, or a defensive lineman. But I think more likely this becomes a conversation about what is it between Seattle and a Super Bowl? Is it an elite wide receiver? Is it secondary? Is it the pass rush? Is it offensive line? What in your mind then is standing between Seattle and a Super Bowl? And if the answer is an elite wide receiver, then yeah, pull the trigger on this trade.
Yeah, that to me is the crux of this conversation, that what it has sparked is sparking the idea of what is better, where is this trade or this type of trade better utilized? So Salk brought up the fact of Stephon Gilmore. Well, Gilmore's 32 years old last year, and guess what? Also, Stephon Gilmore, he had a major setback of a season last year as well. So, I mean, when you're taking that evaluation or having that context added to it, you're taking a risk and a gamble on Gilmore, who just dipped down in production, not got better or stayed stagnant. So are you getting the Stephon Gilmore that you think you're going to get? The same goes for Julio Jones. Now, I would say that in this trade scenario, I am just not against Julio Jones. So there are people out there that say that Julio Jones would be an awful trade, Mike Salk being one of them, and we just talked about it this last segment. If they made the trade, I wouldn't be up in arms against it. I would not say that it was a terrible decision. I look at it as more of a signaling that they are deciding that they are going to be a more offensive-driven, more offensive-minded and focused team than we've ever seen in the Pete Carroll era. People want to bring up Jimmy Graham. To me, that was trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. Didn't even make sense. If you weren't going to adjust your offense for someone like Jimmy Graham, or utilize him as a glorified tight end, a glorified receiver, then what was the point of bringing him in? I mean, that was just pure bad evaluation into thinking that Jimmy Graham was going to be able to turn himself into an adequate run blocker. Julio Jones comes into this offense, he would absolutely fit into this offense, into the style in which Shane Waldron's offense is and what it can do, and it creates major mismatch issues when it comes to Julio Jones, DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett. So I'm saying that I'm not necessarily advocating for it and saying that this is a deal that they have to get done, but I'm not up in arms about it. I think it would be a successful ordeal if this is something that they ended up going with, rather than sitting there and saying, oh, there's no way this would work. This wouldn't be able to get them to a Super Bowl. Well, it definitely wouldn't hurt. I don't think it would prevent them from getting to a Super Bowl. And if you really are looking at your offense and thinking about the ways that you can maintain your offensive firepower, I think, you know, Jones is a potential answer to that equation.
Yeah, I guess no matter what, I always look back to the defense as an issue. And I know that I keep getting back to this conversation, you guys, and maybe it's getting annoying, but I think it's so important. Those four conference teams, four of the top scoring offenses in the league, you've got to be elite on offense. I can absolutely see the argument that bringing in Julio makes you even more elite. And I agree with Dominique Foxworth's take that there are other areas of need. I do not agree with the part of his argument that says they wouldn't be a Super Bowl contender. It changes the conversation about who the Seahawks can be if you bring in Julio. I don't care if you have DK. I don't care if you have Tyler. They're two of the best in the game. Bringing in Julio also changes that conversation. That said, I go back to the team that ended up winning. The team that won it all, brought home the Lombardi, and nearly dropped it in the Bay, are the Buccaneers, who had by far the best defense. And I wonder if when you get to the postseason in your Seattle's defense, can you hang with great offenses? Because you can be as elite as you want on offense. The other elite offenses in the league are also going to make it there.
Yeah, it is. It is a factor. But you also saw 2 years ago with Kansas City, and Kansas City got to a second Super Bowl by having a high-powered offense, an offense that was able to put up points, and a defense that was more, I would say, opportunistic, or the style in which they played was, hey, we're going to get up on people. We're going to force them to have to pass the football, and yet we have a great pass rush and a secondary that is able to turn the ball over. So if you look at the way that the Seahawks defense is set up right now, they went more in on their pass rush, their edge rushers, than we've seen in the past couple years. I don't think that's by accident. And I believe that when you look at this defense as a whole, it's more set up to be that way than be your old dominant defense of old in the Legion of Boom day era. Now, would Pete Carroll love to have that? No question. But I still believe that as you're looking at this team, and as we saw last year, Stace, is why did this team lose?
Right.
Why did this team lose last year? And it was The defense had turned a corner. It was a better defense than what we saw in the first half of the season, but the offense was the thing that fell apart. The offense was the thing that was really struggling in the second half of the season. The offense, in my mind, was the reason why this team didn't go deeper into the playoffs, because of the absolute slide that they experienced in the second half. If that team is firing on all cylinders offensively, we're talking about a different story. And so I believe that when you look at this offense, it has the ability to be special. It has the pieces to be dynamic. And if you added one more dynamic player, it certainly would not hurt in that equation. Now, cap space aside, we're really not even focusing on that part of it, but just talking about the overall play and adding talent, I think that really stands out to me. So I'm not up in arms against this type of trade. I think it would be a bold trade. There would be a lot of things that they would have to figure out, but also adding a 32-year-old Stephon Gilmore, would it be helpful? Yes, but is it the key to getting to a Super Bowl? I still think it's debatable because of this last year's performance of Stephon Gilmore. You just never know in these types of trades, but I do believe that the defense, if you felt like you were adding somebody to that defense, it's a unique defense, it's a unique style. You have to be able to adequately evaluate how it's all going to come together before you make that trade, which they did not do with somebody like Jimmy Graham.
All right, there's so much we need to update you guys about when it comes to the Seahawks. They finished up the last week, their most recent week of OTAs. You've got June mini camp coming up that's mandatory. All kinds of questions. Who better to ask than ESPN's Brady Henderson? He joins us next.